Good evening, everyone. This is the Courtroom Observer's Call. It's 2 August 2017, and it's 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm pleased with the number of people that are here this evening. Right on time, and I think this is the largest group that we've started out with since I've been involved. Thank you. And I see we have New York Michael here. We have did you have anything to discuss this evening, Mike?
Not really, Robert. I've been working with that lady in Indiana on her custody matter with her grandchildren, and I have no news, good news to report or anything of progress yet. But we're still working at that, fighting with that. So I'll keep you guys updated in the event that anything transpires from it.
Well, I hope that there are courtroom observers available for this case.
Yeah, so do I.
Now, I have to say once again that we may not realize just how important courtroom observers are. But I'll tell you, in a lot of cases, the courtroom observer, even just one, can make or break a case. There's been many of them just dismissed simply because a courtroom observer was there taking notes.
Amen to that.
Yes. And just to, you know, the more professional a courtroom observer looks, the more attention they get from the judge and from the district attorney. And when I see the courtroom observers really actively taking notes, especially before court really gets started, because then they know, oh, my God, they're writing down our names, our telephone number, everything about us. They're recording everything. They don't like that. It's putting the spotlight on. And so what a courtroom observer does in a courtroom, you know, it's it gets a lot more attention than what you might realize. The eyes are on you, and you're scaring them. They really don't want to say anything to you, and so most cases they don't. But they're watching you, and many of their decisions are based.
I think what really scares them is they don't know what we know and how much we know and what we're going to do. I think
that's exactly right, but they know that we're doing something because we're not going to be there taking notes unless we have some kind of plan, and that's going through their head. They don't know what we're doing. They've got an idea that it's not good for them. They just don't know how bad it is for them, but they know that the spotlight is on them, and just having the spotlight on them, you know, that's they don't like that. Nothing they can do about it. Now, some of the braver ones might say something, hoping to, hoping to retaliate and put some fear in you. But if you just smile and say, and just look at them, go on doing what you're doing. They know it hasn't bothered you. They're going to stop. Now, you know, when it comes to being a courtroom observer, there are just so many things. I mean, just there's really not much that you need to know. And the more you sit in on a courtroom, on a case, you know, and you become comfortable, the more you realize how wrong, how corrupt they are. But really, you know, when it comes to just a knowledge of what it takes to be a courtroom observer, it's simply being look professional, carry a clipboard, have a name badge. And it doesn't have to be clipped on your clothes. It can be hung on a strap around your neck. It doesn't matter. And that's really all there is to being a courtroom observer. But if you have a working knowledge of the Constitution and civics, the more you'll realize how much a judge or the prosecutor says is nothing but corrupt. It's easier for you to recognize the fact that there is no due process. I don't think there's been any due process in a case in, oh man, years. I don't know how many years, but I'm willing to bet it's been many years since there's been due process anywhere. So, you know, it's, I sat in a juvenile courtroom for a week straight. And it was unbelievable. You know, they don't think the kids have any right whatsoever. If they're a juvenile, they're absolutely, they're not even human in the eyes of the court. I observed a case where the family hired a really good attorney. So many of the families can't afford an attorney, and so they rely on a court appointed. And in a juvenile court, the court appointed, they don't do anything. I mean, they have a script. And as you sit there in a courtroom, you realize more and more that the judge, if he is a judge, it might be just the commissioner, but the judge, the prosecutor, the attorneys, they have a script. And they go through the process. Well, you know, there are some things that's the same every time. And one of the first things is they want to see if a child is eligible for bail. Of course, they never are. They're never eligible. And then they decide to send them out to a child psychologist. And the psychologist always is in on it, and they confirm that now he shouldn't be on it. He or she should not be out on bail. And then the court-appointed attorney, they say, well, I think that doctor was on the payroll, and I want him to see our doctor. Well, our doctor means one of the other doctors that works with the court, but that keeps him in jail without trial for another 2 weeks. It just goes on and on and on. Every little thing just extends the time that a child is in the court, and it's the same words for every child that goes through. And what it is they're making money off of the child being held in jail. I know in the state of Washington, several years ago, it was $67 a day for the care of a child in the detention center. And so they were considered like cash cows. Well, they even do that to adults in a lot of cases now. But this one case where they had a good attorney, he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the child that he represented could not possibly have committed the crime for which he was charged. The judge said, you've done a very fine job of defending this child. However, no child is totally innocent. He's done something. Maybe he didn't do what he was charged with here, but he's done something. So he's going down. And they'll give him so many weeks, maybe 6 months. Yeah, that happened. Proved innocent. The judge sentenced him to time in jail anyway. And that happens a lot. These are things that when you're a courtroom observer, you need to make sure that you write these things down. It's bad enough with adults. It's even worse with a child. And you may go to a child's, a juvenile court. It's sad. Very sad. But you need to write everything. You need to take very good notes so you can write an affidavit. The affidavit is the most intense thing that you do as a courtroom observer, but after you've written a couple of them, that's no big deal either. Now, is there anything that somebody else would like to talk about? Johnny, how about you?
Yeah, Robert, this is Gooden. How are you?
Yeah,
I just came in on the call here. We have 100-degree weather. I just took a little bit of a break and
ended up hot.
Having to take a nap, so I'm just coming around here. But, working with a group
when you're doing courtroom observation, this has been the best experience for us. I've been in a few courtroom situations where it was just me or one other person. And so the more people, the better. And the more understanding the background you have on the case, the more you can understand where stuff is going wrong, you know. Like recently we had a case where a defendant for a code, actually a code violation, the private land and with the county, and they wanted to lower the boom on them for having too many animals. They rezoned the area, and they put it more under, instead of farming land, they made it rural residential. And so they kind of didn't really have a right to do that, to rezone the area, and then ask the people to, you know, oh, you got too many animals on your property. Oh, you got somebody living out in your camper over there. You can't have that, you know. And just write citations and then issue them out to the people there, and then they show up in court, and first thing they do is they ask them if they want to enter a plea, you know. So luckily they were able to contact a gentleman that we have who's a counselor at law, and Ron, he's been a minor for, oh gosh, probably over almost 50 years, and he was also a law student when he took law. He took engineering and he took law courses. So, and ever since he started working in the mining industry, he's had to defend himself and also worked on defending his friends, his fellow miners. And then he worked in the mining association. And a lot of what we have over here is, of course, federal lands and public lands, and so people's mining claims were being violated against, and he recently started up a process about 10 years ago of securing land patents, you know, bringing your land deed forward, and so he's been doing a good job at using the law of the land to defend, and the Constitution to defend those law patents. And this fellow, his family, you know, recently secured their and brought their land patent forward, and so it made it easy for him to go in to the courtroom and demand by what jurisdiction do you charge these people. They do not consent to the jurisdiction. They do not give it subject matter or personal jurisdiction. So by what manner of jurisdiction do you call this proceeding? And of course, then the presiding magistrate, the hearings officer, took the court offline. He took it off record to address his question. But while he was taking it off record, he was still trying to get the discredit the participation as a stand-in, you know, person. There's the friend initiative or friend representative that is legal. Legally, you can represent a friend of yours if you have some understanding of law. So you don't need to be credentialed. You don't have to be a bar lawyer in order to represent somebody in a court case. So, and that's what we've worked on. A group of us have, of course, we were in the same class together with Ron as our teacher, and been learning the last four or five years about land patents and
court procedures and the difference between administrative law, law and rem, and also the common law and constitutional law settings. So there was a constitutional or Article III court in Eugene. There's only one court that presides in Oregon that is Article III. But other than that, it's far and few in between. Everything is a morphodite of the mercantile type courts that England noted them back during when the merchant and the admiralty courts more and more developed, and the merchants started using the admiralty courts, basically contract law is what it is. But we've been subjugated to so much one-sided contracts. Now that we're drafted into contract without our own knowledge, and because we don't know that we are under contract, they bring us, they assume jurisdiction over us, and we don't know how to challenge, you know, their jurisdiction. You know, and actually, you can challenge jurisdiction at any time in the proceedings. But it isn't done very much, so they try to slough it off, you know, and not account for identifying where in law is their jurisdiction. So especially when there isn't an injured party, like with a code violation, or a nuisance ordinance, or a mining law infraction. So, but yeah, it's been really rewarding this recent case, and we're looking forward. We'll probably know more in a few weeks. We're having a law study meeting on the case this coming Sunday, and. We'll have more of a determination, more of an idea of what the determination is to cite the hearings officer because he was guaranteed that a lawsuit would be forthcoming to him if he did not stop his proceedings and rescind his default ruling. He made a default ruling. After he closed down the hearing and took it off record, and then issued a $1,800 fine, $600 for each of the three infractions. So, okay. Anything else? You can just, if you got a question, or if there's anybody out there that has any input that you'd be interested to hear on how your experience has been as a courtroom observer or courtroom witness. I yield. Thank you, Robert.
Yep. Thank you. Is there anybody else that has any input or like any
Robert, this is Jan in Kansas.
Yes.
And I could add that my mother was sent about a $4,000 bill from a nursing home pharmacy, and I wouldn't pay it until they told her what, I mean, I didn't pay it, I was her DPOA, but I wouldn't write the check until they gave us an itemized statement of what they were charging her for. Well, they refused to give her an itemized statement. They said that they'd already sent her one and they weren't sending another one. This went on for like 2 years. I'm not going to get into all the details, but the point that I wanted to make was that even though they wouldn't furnish an itemized statement, they finally did after a year and a half, and we could not read it. It was illegible or unreadable, you know. And so then it took another approximate 6 months to get one that we could read. And so the judge said that they basically, he said that it was okay for them not to have sent her a statement, because I was asking for, I had to hire an attorney and all that, and I was asking for her money back, and they said no, they couldn't give it back, because basically that it was okay for people to bill the older people and not tell them what to bill for. And I even went to the library and looked up our Kansas statutes for dependent adults, you know, and how there are statutes on the books in Kansas that where they're protected from business practices like that. And I presented them to the judge over the objections of the prosecutor or the plaintiff's attorney. Excuse me, I don't know these terms real well. But anyway, so he said, the judge said, or the magistrate said, well, I can't rule in your favor because of the way that the laws are written. And he asked me if I knew who my legislators were, and I said yes. And so I have contacted them and on and on. But anyway, so about, last fall, I went downtown, and I was around the courthouse, and I went looking for the judge because I'd already been listening to NLA and different other people and groups, and I wanted to ask him about jurisdiction because he was did seem like a very nice person, although I know that they probably aren't nice since they do this to people. But so I found him, and he didn't remember the case, but I said, well, was I kind of explained it to him a little bit, and I said, was that maritime jurisdiction that she was under in that court? And he kind of laughed a little bit, and he said, no, it couldn't be. It's not maritime jurisdiction. And so I went on, I don't remember what I said, but whatever I had learned from NLA and you guys, and I said, basically, well, then what kind of jurisdiction was it? And the answer that he gave me, he said it this way. He said, well, it's blended jurisdiction. And I just dropped it right there. You know, I just told him, okay, well, I don't know what that means. And I think he said something like the cake, you know, how it's got different layers. And that was what I had learned from you guys, you know, that they can move from one jurisdiction to the other. But for that particular case, his answer that was that it was blended.
Yeah,
and well, that was what I wanted to say. So I'm done.
Oh, okay. Well, that's... I think that comes out quite often in a court case, and that's something that courtroom observers, when they have a little knowledge of the Constitution and have been in a courtroom a few times, they start picking up on that kind of stuff, and those are things to write down, make notes for the affidavit. See, that happens. That happens more than you might think. Now, he said it wasn't
maritime.
Yeah, it wasn't maritime. But all one needs to do is look at the flag. If it's got the gold fringe, you know dang well it is.
Yeah, and not only that, but I've also looked in, I don't know all the details about what I'm talking about, but it was an insurance matter at its essence. And so I do have read that anything that has to do with insurance, now, like I say, I'm not sure this is true, but I've read that anything that has to do with insurance is the law of the sea. And that was why I asked him, was it maritime?
Well, you know, I'm not an attorney, and I can't give advice there, but one thing
well,
I can say is...
Yeah.
One thing I can say is the fact that a state law that is repugnant to the federal constitution is null and void.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, this is Gunder here in Oregon.
Yes, Gunder.
Yeah, they have to show you by what statute under state law that they are determining their jurisdiction. They can't just give you a guess at it like it's a mix of this and that without being anywhat clear. So once jurisdiction is challenged, the court cannot proceed when it clearly appears that the court lacks jurisdiction. And in that case, that's what it was, because he couldn't, the magistrate couldn't identify clearly to you by what statute that case was, what jurisdiction under which statute that case was brought forward. So basically, it sounds like it was like a one-way contract. So they don't like to identify that you were sucked into something that law requires them, or administrative law requires them to rule against the people. But we know that the Bar Association and all of the lawyers take a sort of a sacred untold oath, at least within the public, that part of one of their main points is to divest the public of their assets. So, and especially when it comes to land. So whenever there is a dispute, they're supposed to determine. That's why when they bring you into court, they ask you for a plea right away, whether you are guilty or not guilty. When you say that you're not guilty, you're agreeing to the proceedings, and you're agreeing and bringing forth their jurisdiction. So once you challenge their jurisdiction, then they have to prove by what manner. Like if somebody has charges against you and you've damaged somebody, then you're called into the jurisdiction of that particular county or that district. You know, and then after that, then you can, if you get a ruling against you, you can take that to an appellate court. So that's the thing, is to challenge jurisdiction. And a few good places to read about that, I can give you some case law. And one of them is Mello versus U.S. That's M-E-L-O.
Wait a minute, just 1 second. I got to get a pen.
Sure.
Okay, I'm ready.
It's Mello, M-E-L-O, capital M-E, with an E-L-O, Mello versus U.S., which is a Supreme Court decision. And then there's a comma, and then 505, capital F, 2, small d, and then the last citation is 1026.
Okay.
So if you Google that, you can bring up that particular law case in the Supreme Court, and also the proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency in all administrative proceedings. It's supposed to appear on the record by what jurisdiction that they are serving you with, you know. And there's another court case which is very good, which is called Hagans versus Levine, and that's H-A-G-A-N-S versus V, Levine, L-A-V-I-N-E, and the citation there is 415, capital U, dot, capital S, dot, 533. So those are two cases that you can read through
Okay, I'm going to read that back to you if it's all right.
Sure,
it's,
go ahead.
Mello versus U.S., and then it's 55, F is in Frank, 2 is in dog, I mean 2, and then small b is in dog, and then it's 1026. And then the other one is Hagen's with an S versus Levine, L-A-V-I-N-E. I'm trying to hurry to this. 415-U-S is in United States, 533.
Correct. Yeah, the Mello versus U.S. citation is 505, capital F, 2D, 1026.
Okay.
So I think you said 55.
I might have because I was 505.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, it's 505. You got it. That's it. Those are two cases that you can read through and learn about how they define jurisdiction.
Yeah, because I think that's the key, the jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
you know, really.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And a note to courtroom observers. When somebody challenges jurisdiction, pay attention. Make a note of it. Listen to what the judge says about it. Write down, you know, keep a record of what is transpiring there. Could come in handy for the defendant later. Should go in the affidavit.
Well, can a courtroom observer ask for the jurisdiction?
No.
No.
So the courtroom observer is simply there to observe the proceedings and record it.
Okay.
They don't have any authority to ask for it or anything.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that you'll find as a courtroom observer, and it's always good, is that the defendant should, unless the judge is actually ruling for the defendant, the defendant should object to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always good for the observer to make notes.
Robert, there's a lot of background noise. Would you please repeat that?
Okay. Well, it's a defendant should always object to everything, unless, of course, the judge is ruling in their favor. But usually that's not going to happen, so... Yeah, it's always a good idea to object to everything. And it's never a good idea to be talking and saying too much. I know it's, you know, that's just from my observation. It's not from, I'm not giving legal advice. I'm just, what I observe is it's, and I would always want to object. It's just a. Otherwise,
your,
you know.
By what authority are they objecting?
Well, you could. Everyone could be different. It might be object relevance, not truthful or whatever.
I see.
Yeah, basically you object to the jurisdiction. Proof of jurisdiction.
That's what I was thinking. Couldn't you just object to the subject matter jurisdiction to begin with?
Correct. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if they can't even tell you the jurisdiction, then how do they know they've got jurisdiction over the subject matter? And how do you know that they do?
That's
for
right.
Sure.
They have to prove it from the beginning, and it's supposed to be on record. By what statute that they are determining jurisdiction and how they are applying it.
Okay. Oh, I like that.
But this is where the courtroom observer needs to be taking these notes. They need to write all this stuff down and record it all.
Robert?
Yes?
Something just came to my mind. In court, all the courtroom observing that I have done, and even in my own cases, one of the big problems that the court has is when people give testimony against the party that you're there to help witness for. Number one, they're never, ever a competent fact witness. So by not
right.
being a competent fact witness, basically they have no standing, and you have to object immediately. That's an immediate objection.
Absolutely.
Because that's hearsay evidence.
If you don't object, then
you can't bring it up with it.
Yeah, you're actually saying by your silence that you agree with them.
Right. That's an important thing to remember. A competent fact witness has to give testimony. And even in the affidavit especially, when CPS comes in and files an affidavit to the courtroom about all of the things that they have determined that a person is guilty of in their mind, they do not have any facts to prove that. It's all hearsay. And the judges and the guardian ad litems, they always rule in the favor of a fraudulent testimony.
Right. And also, you know, I'm pushing the courtroom observer to record all of this because too often records become erased.
Yes.
And so if you have it recorded and it's on an affidavit, all right. That's good.
And testimony becomes lost as well. Oral testimony.
Yeah. If it's an affidavit and it's notarized, it's testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah. And you assign it to the case that you witnessed. So it becomes part of the it becomes an adjunct to the case because it's an official witness, especially if you get more than two people. You know, it's good to have three people or more submit. Then it becomes more weighty, especially in the appellate process. And then when the appellate judges review the case, then they take the witness of the case in hand and look at that, especially if your witnesses now have a good briefing on the case and can cite the violations. Number one, you cite what the magistrate or what the hearings officer, the prosecution, has done that you felt was incorrect. If you can cite a case in regards to their violation or a statute, and kind of hang them on their own law, and then you cite that information after, as a point of law. So, and then you can go into your understanding. And if you have other witnesses that said, yes, we concur, I also concur with Jack, who was an observer and a witness to this particular case, that this statute or this code or this proceedings hearing, they have a certain administrative proceeding hearing format that they have to follow. And if they don't follow it properly, then you can cite them for it. You can cite it in your affidavit. And after the fact of you're writing down the what the magistrate said, and for instance, in our case, how the person representing the defendant made the statement, by what jurisdiction. He agreed to, the people had come forward to have him represent them, and the hearings officer tried to discredit
the person who was a representative, he was saying that, oh, well, you need a real lawyer. You need somebody with a bar card that can officially take your case. You know, you don't know who this person is. You know, you don't know his background, stuff like that. He was three times he tried to get the people to come up and to discard Gibson's representation for the people. And but they stood fast and listened to him. They said, no, don't take the stand. First, we need to hear by what authority that this hearing is taking place. I got to pop over to the Allstate call next week after the clash and refocusing on the actions after the hearing and the I'll have more information to bring about the court case that we have, the hearings case that we have with the people that challenge jurisdiction. So I'll put together a little cheat sheet on how to challenge jurisdiction for you. Give you a little bit more background on the case because I'm just kind of bobbling through it. I don't have my notes and stuff in front of me. Okay.
Well, anyway, as a courtroom observer, I think in listening to tonight's conversation, you are beginning to realize the importance of having courtroom observers taking notes in the courtroom. If you're a defendant, and you know your mind's on the case, you're not hearing everything. Maybe you're not able to write it all down. You maybe not have a record of it. So it's important that the courtroom observers take good notes and write an affidavit for the defendants. And you know, they might be able to get the transcripts, but are they all there? I mean, have they erased anything? By having good notes and writing an affidavit, you know, you might provide the winning information for that defendant.
Well, do we give a copy to the defendant? No.
Take them notes. Find out from the defendant. You know, if it's going to go beyond that day, ask them, are you going to fight this case? And if they are, give them a copy of those notes, but write them an affidavit. And have the information from the defendants how to contact them so you can get that affidavit to them.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Write it and have it notarized and give it to them.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Robert, something that I do, what I do when I do a court observing is I'll do an affidavit and I'll fill it out right there in the courtroom. And then I'll walk over to the clerk's office, and I'll ask her to notarize it.
There you go.
And they'll notarize it right then and there. And then I'll say, would you please put this in the case file such and such? And the number's already on the affidavit, and the name of the defendant, and the name of the people coming after them, and the whole case number. And I'll
Very
say, would
good.
You
That's excellent.
Put this right into the case file so it's there for further review.
Very good.
Okay.
Even Excellent. If it takes you a few minutes after the court case to sit down and get your thoughts together and write it so that it makes sense and it's nice and plain and simple, one statement, one thought, one sentence, and just put it into the case. It doesn't have to be long. In fact, the shorter, the better. And that way it's there, and then you can give one to the defendant also on their way out. Or give them your phone number for contact or whatever the case is.
And we're doing that because we are part of the public who is affected by these decisions. If we're asked, is that why we're doing that? Because that's why I'm doing it. If I can get a partner, that's why I'll be doing it.
We are.
You know, if we don't do it for others, you know, who's going to be there for us when it's our turn?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just like a police officer, we are a witness to the injustice.
Okay. Okay.
And if ever they want to file a criminal complaint, then they have that affidavit to verify the fact that the statements that were brought up in the courtroom were either lies or they were not competent fact witnesses, and that they were just making up a story in order to prosecute somebody and harass them.
Okay. Yeah.
For causing
justice. Hey, Robert, can you hear me? Robert?
Yes.
Do you guys know about the, there are in every criminal case there has to be two essential elements. One of them is mens rea, which is present of criminal minds. And other one is actus reus, which is guilty act. So in other words, every act, every element of crime must be proven. So what you guys talking about, how to approach, even if you are brought in front of the judge in the courtroom, they have to prove the elements of crimes.
That's right.
And one of them is mens rea, which is you have to be guilty mind. And second one, it has to be actus reus, which is guilty act. You did it or you not, or you have a present of the, did you plan this act? So that don't worry about, you know, the corrupting courts in the beginning,
right.
You know, what jurisdiction they are. That's true what you guys saying. That is you always object. You ask guys, you object to jurisdiction. We have two jurisdiction on the land, in law and in equity. And he have to tell you in which one you at. And then you object because he knows then you may appeal because he's acting unlawfully. That's what I want to say.
In the New York State statutes and criminal law and traffic law, every one of them states that you have to do it with intent.
Oh.
And that's mens rea. That's the mens rea that he's talking about.
Oh, I see. Is that the mind part?
Yes.
Okay.
If you don't know you're doing wrong, you can't be convicted of being guilty of it.
And you read, when you read the statute, you make up as many elements as possible and just, you know, bring up into the court, and they must prove it, every one of them.
You want to hear something funny? One time I was in court, and I had the police officer on the stand, and I asked him if he's the one that filed the criminal complaint, and he said yes, he did. And I asked him, I said, okay, for the record, would you please tell the court what the elements are for a criminal complaint, please?
Oh.
And he looked at me just like I smacked him in the face. He had no idea. He had no idea what the elements of a criminal complaint were. So I says, Your Honor, I says, this is an incompetent witness.
Okay.
I want his testimony and his complaint stricken from the record because he's incompetent.
Okay. Taking notes here. What was the other one that the gentleman had said? It was Miss Ray, and what was the other? It was
actus reus. Actus reus. Mens rea and actus reus.
And what does the other actus reus mean?
It means guilty act. You done it or not?
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. Guilty or not. Okay, thank you.
It's very simple. You play with that.
See, they have escapes for everything, and we just have to understand what they are and how to use their law against them.
Yeah. Well, can we have somebody explain to us what, like, the elements are. Can we get this, like, where all of us can take notes and so that we know when we go into the courtroom observing that, like, that it's, there was no intent. We can sit out there and listen to the testimony and then put that in our affidavit that there was no intent, or this element, there must be five elements and this one was missing, you know, and do it that way?
Yeah, well, John gave a good Monday night testimony when he was describing on the course Juris Dictionary, Peter Graves from Florida. I bought that course, well, 5-6 years ago, and that is the most excellent form of procedure that you could ever understand. And he goes through the elements of a lot of the different charges. And now, if ever you have a question, just figure out what the charge is. Okay, say the statute number. And if you have a computer, just type it in and then put down, in parentheses, elements of that crime. And it will describe whatever the elements for that state are required for that, in order for it to have any effect. And then you can look at it. You can look at it, and then you can determine for yourself which elements are not there. And it has to have a four-cornered rule, they call it. Like a chair has to have four legs. And every one of those elements has to be there. If one is missing, then it's null and void.
Okay. Taking notes here.
If you are in the, for example, if in equity, you always ask the opposition if they have a contract with you.
Okay.
In law, actually, you know, I have a problem. What is the law? What is not? I always say the statute is not the law. Law is in your heart, which you created, give it to you.
Yeah.
Statute is the man's law. And as we know, they have to tell you in what jurisdiction you are at, and you must ask. If they don't tell you, you know, you can appeal later, because whatever they do, like the gentleman stated earlier, the jurisdiction must be proven in the court and not like come later or something like that. There's many, many ways, but most of us, we go to the court, we're very apprehended, you know, we don't understand, but just look like you are free person first. They attacking you, they drag you over there, and there is many obstacles which they have to prove.
Yes.
Be prepared when you bring up the jurisdictional challenge to the judge or to the prosecutor. They're going to say, they'll give you some kind of goofy, like what you had said about your case.
Yeah.
It's a mixed jurisdiction, or some off-the-wall name, like in New York, they're using all kinds of different names. But they will come back and they will say, if you don't understand this proceeding, you are to hire an attorney. We cannot give you legal advice.
Yeah.
This is what they've told me many times.
There is such a thing like void for vagueness, and it says when you read and you don't understand, the law is void or statute is void. It doesn't tell you. Go to somebody else to explain to you. Void for vagueness. Law is vague when the guy with the IQ of 50 read it and do not understand.
So right. Does that stand, void for vagueness?
Yeah. If you read the law, it doesn't say go to lawyer. He can tell you.
Yeah.
This is also a pretty good defense. Judge, why am I supposed to pay somebody? How do I know he knows?
Exactly.
That's it. How do I know he knows?
Just Google it, and you will see it. There's so many cases, so many court opinion, lower and higher. Mm-hmm. But it tells when men of average IQ read the statute that he do not understand, the statute or the law is void. Void for vagueness, because it's not understandable to common man.
Okay.
It doesn't tell you, go to somebody else, he will tell you. Oh, no. We're not such a country.
So then what I always say is, well, thank you very much for that information, Your Honor, and I will take that under advisement And the advisement is that you're acting under color of law and there is no jurisdiction.
He pressing you to spend the money on his body.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you say that you'll take that under advisement and he is acting under color of law?
I'll take it as you're acting under color of law then, if you won't explain what the jurisdiction is.
Oh, you've said that?
Yes.
The best way, you always ask the judge. You always form the question to him, and he is there to answer it to you.
Okay.
He didn't give you the orders, because the jury make the verdicts, not him.
That's okay. True. Yes, thank you.
I want to say something about that contract. That fellow was talking about a contract. You ask them, what is the contract that I am liable to? Please furnish me a copy of the original signature on the contract that you claim that I am responsible for.
Okay, they couldn't give me that for Mom either.
No. And then, even if they did, now, you have to look at that thing and they say, well, that's your signature on there. Well, guess what? There was no meeting of the minds. Maybe that's my handwriting, but that's not my signature. A signature is different than your handwriting. A signature is when you have a meeting of the minds and every term on that contract and condition that they have explained to you what it is, especially if they wrote the contract and not you.
Yes. Okay.
So therefore, that's not your signature because you were not aware of all of the terms and conditions of the contract.
Okay. And that goes back to intention and intent. It all goes in a circle, doesn't it?
The way I understand the law is very simple. If there is injury to your body, there has to be the physician report, exam. Or if there is the injury to his property, you should furnish me the insurance claim. Everything else for me is the fiction.
Okay.
But a lot of people don't have insurance on everything.
Well, look, if somebody do something wrong to you, you know, if I am in the court, I ask him, okay, you claim I ruin your car. Or give me the proof, give me the estimate for the insurance, how much my action, how much the damage is in the value of, you know, Federal Reserve note.
Right.
If I injure your body, okay, please prove me that the doctor shows me the, give me the physician report.
And don't they have to, oops, I'm sorry.
That's the way I see the law. There has to be injury, and it has to be proven by the doctor or by insurance claim. There could be the injury to be to your body or to your property, and everything else is the fiction.
Yeah, it would also have to be accompanied by an oath or affirmation from the accuser, a sworn witness.
Yes. But you know that you don't have to, because these two things, you know, they don't have a case. For example, there's another thing. Can you cross-examine the witness in the court? Obviously, is yes. Can you listen to this? This is the fiction. If they charge you with violating some statute, why don't you call the statute and cross-examine the statute? Hey, statute. Have you been in the hospital? Did I broke your leg? That's the fiction.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. Thank you for that, too. Cross-examine the statute.
Okay,
well,
folks.
Since you violated, can you cross-examine the one who you violated?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So no, I think we've had an interesting hour.
Oh, yeah.
And we're, it's time for us to cut out of here.
Before you shut it down, there's a news flash from NLA headquarters. The
what?
Sunday night call The number has changed. So I just want to make sure everybody knows that. The other number remains the same, the one you called in today.
What is the new number?
It's coming out. It'll be out in a message from Jam.
We already got a message.
Yeah, it's already gone out. Yep.
It's already gone out. So you have
that
it in your mail.
Courtroom observers.
Say
will
again?
That be for the courtroom observers?
Remains the same.
No. All of the committees will remain the same as they are right now. Only the Monday night call has changed.
Oh, the Monday call.
Yep,
yeah.
Only
okay.
The Monday.
Can you go ahead and give that?
Yes.
I think probably it'd be best if you just read the email.
I didn't get an email. I'll look online. That's okay. I can look online. They'll have it posted on the website.
That's right.
I don't have email, so I could never get it.
I see.
That's all right. It'll be posted.